G'day, we're Atlassian, the makers behind popular teamwork software like Jira, Trello, and Confluence. Whether it's real-time collaboration or staying aligned on key goals, Atlassian's agile work management solutions empower dev, business, and IT teams across the whole enterprise to work more efficiently together. It's exactly why 83% of the Fortune 500 trust Atlassian every day to stay agile and move work forward. See what Atlassian can do for your teams at atlassian.com.
Tableau wasn't just any pop music star. He was the biggest thing in Korean hip-hop. But then, rumors on an anonymous internet forum started to spread, saying that Tableau wasn't who we said he was. I'm Dexter Thomas, the host of a new podcast from Vice about a bizarre conspiracy theory that became an obsession not only in Korea, but internationally. All of season one is out now for listening. You can check the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts for Authentic, the story of Tableau.
Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami is a new podcast about, you guessed it, crime in Miami. As Miami natives, we like to say that South Florida is a sunny place for shady people.
I'm Kareem Tapsch.
And I'm Joey Dowd. Each week, this podcast will bring you new stories of true crimes committed right under the Florida sun.
From the outrageous
to the utterly bizarre. This is Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami, a new true crime podcast.
Listen to Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami starting May 18th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Cavalry Audio.
The early history of the island of Manhattan is fascinating for a multitude of reasons, not the least of which is the mosaic of characters that populate it. The indigenous Munsee Algonquins passed down varying tales of white men visiting in great floating houses going back at least a century before Henry Hudson ever arrived here. And in our episodes, Yap outlines for us the four key components of this necessarily chronological process of forging a society in the wilderness. Discovery, trade, settlement, and colonization. So the first part of that, discovery, is fairly well established. In 1609, Henry Hudson was the first European to document the existence of what is today the New York Bay and the river that now bears his name, adequately enough for the rest of the world to be able to find it once he left. Then the trade part of that process was developed and solidified masterfully by the inimitably diplomatic and cerebral Adrian Block. And now the third portion, settlement, was really initiated by a 20-year-old kid by the name of Jacob Elkins, an eager young Dutchman who, as the illegitimate son of a Catholic man whose family had ties to the fur trade in Rouen, France, found himself motivated differently than a lot of other Dutchmen coming of age in his day. As an illegitimate fallen Catholic, Jacob's dubious origins affected the way he would deal with the native Algonquins. Jacob was intent on making connections with the natives. It was very important to him. He learned their languages better than most any other European, and he learned their customs, to the point that he became a trusted emissary of the Algonquins and this burgeoning trade. But there was something that happened after the trade portion which inspired Jacob's boss, Lambert van Twainhuysen, to pursue the third portion, settlement. And that was the arrival of a man by the name of Juan Rodriguez. Now, among these Dutch sailors, Juan stuck out in many ways. He didn't look like any of the Europeans who had come here by 1613. And that was because Juan Rodriguez didn't come from Europe, even though his father did. Juan Rodriguez was the son of a Spanish sailor and a mother of African descent, but who was a resident of the Spanish colony known as La Española, or the Spanish one, as named by Columbus himself in 1492. And through a series of mishaps and calamities, Juan Rodriguez, in his relentless refusal to accept oppression wherever it found him, would depart the Dutch ship that brought him to Manhattan from his Caribbean homeland and defiantly insist on staying here in the fall of 1613. And in doing so, This young man of Spanish, African, and Dominican descent not only inspired the Dutch to colonize this wild new land for the very first time, but in the process, he became the very first immigrant to this incredible place way before it even had a proper name. This is the podcast Island, the story of how this culture, this world, this island, the place we now know as New York, came to be. My name is Chance Kelly, and I look forward to you saying, wow, history is cool. This is a special bonus episode examining the incredible documented history of Juan Rodriguez, our very first immigrant to this incredible city. Welcome aboard. Damas and Aaron, damas y caballeros, ladies and gentlemen, our guest today is somebody who I'm going to guess that most of you don't know, and that's perfectly fine. He doesn't live in New York. He's not from New York. And as far as I know, he hasn't performed in New York. Not yet, anyway. But though you may not know this young man, I imagine that if you do live in New York, or if you ever lived in New York, that you knew somebody of Dominican descent, or perhaps you yourself are of Dominican descent. But what if I told you that through all the international competition that was coming here, that was suddenly jockeying for position in the tumultuous wake of Henry Hudson's momentous voyage in 1609, the English, the Dutch, the French, the Spanish, and a little bit down the line, even the Swedes, that of all those major powers aggressively vying for colonization of this new world, that the very first person to actually jump off a ship, say goodbye to it, and stay here for the first time, the first true immigrant to this incredible city, was not from any of those countries. In fact, he was from the place that we now call the Dominican Republic. And this character who jumped off that ship by the name of Juan Rodriguez arrived here a long time ago, in 1613, to be exact. And Juan Rodriguez becomes one of the more intriguing characters in a vast array of intriguing characters throughout this remarkable history of this incredible island. Yet our guest today himself is not, in fact, Dominican. Rather, he's Dutch. And he became acquainted with this very unique character because of his very specialized ability to translate Dutch. 17th century Dutch, to be exact, long script. And that is because that is what the primary sources concerning the arrival of Juan Rodriguez on the Hudson River are written in. You got it? He was hired to dig into these primary sources on this nebulous character and to unearth whatever he possibly could about this Dominican immigrant in 1613. Some sources had been translated poorly or incorrectly, others that had never really been analyzed for this specific investigation. And what he came up with is nothing short of remarkable. So with that, I am very, very happy and honored to welcome our very next historical excavator from his home base in the city of Culemborg in the Netherlands, Mr. Tom Vetterings. Welcome in here.
Thank you.
Okay. So Tom, hello. Thank you so much for being here. This is for someone just tuning in, that might be a lot of information to give. So you are a graduate of historical studies from Leiden University in the Netherlands.
Yes, that's right.
And You had the unique and unusual ability to translate 17th century Dutch documents.
Yeah, indeed.
Which is not easy, which I wouldn't even try. Tell us how you happened upon this story of Juan Rodriguez.
Right. So it started out by And my other, I also studied at Amsterdam University, or the University of Amsterdam, as it's formerly known. And right there, I had a tutor, I believe, who at some point was contacted by the Dominican Studies Institute of the City University of New York, if he knew of somebody who could help them find and translate the original documents that they knew would work, that they knew existed on Juan Rodriguez. So he then referred them to me. Well, there we are. I came into contact with them. I looked up the original documents on Juan Rodriguez in the Amsterdam City Archives. And went ahead and translated them, and then together with Anthony Stevens Acevedo of the Dominican Studies Institute and Leonor Alvarez Frances of actually the University of Amsterdam, together we wrote a little book about Juan Rodriguez to give more information about his history, because as I understood it then and as I still understand it now, he was a rather unknown figure in the early history of New York, and his story is definitely worth telling. So, yeah, that's how we arrived. There.
I want to mention that the document that you it's an incredible, it's a book, really. It's an article, I suppose, is what you call it, but it's a long, very in-depth article, and it's called Juan Rodriguez: The Beginnings of New York City. And it actually, I believe it is available online, correct?
It is, yes, yes. Yeah. I think the Dominican Studies Institute makes it available.
Yes, yes.
I should say that Anthony was the main author of the piece. So I mostly did the translating, the transcribing and translating of the documents, and of course provided some input on what I thought was going on. But he was the main author.
Okay, so let's get into that then, because... people had known something about Juan Rodriguez, and I have read from a few different sources about Juan Rodriguez, and I, including Simon Hart's Prehistory of the New Netherland Company. But you had said that you actually found some inaccuracies, and you went back and retranslated some of that material, correct?
Yeah. So Anthony and the others at the Dominican Studies Institute, or the DSI, they felt that it was prudent, as often is, to go back to the original sources. So all that was available to the general public at that time was, I think, Simon Hart's translation. And Simon Hart's translation obviously did not include anything from the originals, so neither a photograph nor a transcription in the original Dutch. I went back and looked up those documents, and there were some minor inaccuracies. I have to say that Simon Hart, in large respects, his translation was pretty sound. But yeah, just simply by the fact that you look at these documents new and look at the originals and get a feeling of what the people described in the documents were actually saying, you get a much better view of what has actually happened.
Not everybody who listens to this or watches this particular podcast, Island Voices, is real acquainted with a lot of the history and a lot of the historical processes. Talk about the what a primary source is and what the significance of that is to historical research and historical writing and teaching.
Right. So, a primary resource is a source, a document, usually, although it could in theory also be an object, from the original time period that you're investigating. So in this case, we're talking about two documents, really, notarial documents, so legal documents. What happened is that these are the descriptions from certain members of the ship's crews when they arrived back in Amsterdam. And it was normal at the time when a ship arrived back in Amsterdam to take declarations from the ship's crews to get a view of what had happened on the voyage. In this particular case, that's also because there was very clear dispute between the ship's masters that encountered each other in the New Netherland area. And in the course of that description, they also told the story of Juan Rodriguez. So in this case, lacking Juan Rodriguez's own description of what has happened, we don't have, as far as I know, and I think as far as anybody knows, any direct description of his story. We only have the description of some of the people who met him as to what happened to him and what he did and where he went.
So why are the primary sources in Dutch and not Spanish if he was from a Spanish colony?
Ah, right. Because in this case, he was a crew member on the Dutch ship. So the ships in these cases, as I said, there were two documents. I think the first document has descriptions from certain crew members of two ships. I think the other has one or two ships. I'm not fully remembering from the top of my head.
Sure. Yeah.
And these ships were based in Amsterdam. So their captains, their owners, they were based in Amsterdam. The crews themselves were not necessarily Dutch, although in this case, I think most of the crewmen giving descriptions were. Obviously, the notary was in Dutch. Some was Dutch. Some of the crewmen may have been German. We know that some of them are from places now currently in Germany, but back in those days, that was very common, especially on Dutch ships, that that crew members came from several places across Northwestern Europe.
Right. So talk to me a little bit about what some of the things that you unearthed in your research, because I thought some of it was incredibly interesting, very, very fascinating what you found out about this guy, because you looked in three primary source locations, correct?
Two, actually. So there's two specific documents mentioning him. So the book that was written also has a number of Spanish documents, actually. And what the intention of including those was, is they have descriptions of people called Jan Rodriguez or Juan Rodriguez, born in the Santo Domingo area around the time, well, corresponding with the time that the ships would have arrived in Hispaniola a decade or so afterwards. So the thinking is that one of these people might actually be the Jan Rodriguez. We don't exactly know which is which. I mean, Jan Rodriguez itself is, I think, a fairly common name in Spanish. But the two Dutch notarial acts, they give a very clear description as to what happened. So the first one is from 1613, and it gives a very clear description as to what happened with Juan Rodriguez. He basically, he was a crew member on the ship of Thijs Mossel, and he indicated that he was very clear about the fact that he did not want to continue the voyage back to the Netherlands. So we do not know for certain if he ever was in the Netherlands. It doesn't necessarily seem unlikely. He may have made earlier voyages with this crew. He may, in theory, also have been picked up earlier during the same voyage, but it's not really possible to determine. In either case, he didn't want to go back with the rest of the ship to the Netherlands. So he jumped ship, literally. They gave him some supplies, mostly, I believe, 80 hatchets.
Right.
A saber and a musket, if I'm not mistaken. As they said, in lieu of payment, so instead of him receiving his actual pay, which would have been pretty worthless in any case on the coast of New Netherland at that time, they gave him stuff that he could presumably trade or use to hunt or defend himself. And that was that. Basically, he wasn't seen again until the next year. So that's the second document from 1614, where we have a clear description of dispute between the ships of, Thijs Mossel, as I mentioned, and the other one.
It was the 410 with Adrian Block and Hendrik Christensen.
Yes, indeed. And they had a very clear trade dispute about who should be allowed to trade with the local populace. And at that point, we encounter Jan Rodriguez again. This is actually the first time that he's actually named. So he isn't named in the first document, but it's very easy to make out that it must be the same man. And he apparently was now aiding the trade of Hendrik Christiansen and not Thijs Mossel. So Thijs Mossel presumably was enraged by this fact, and they attacked him. They wounded him even. And after that, he basically disappears from the story again. So we don't know, for example, if he was left there in a wounded state. From the document, it seems clear that the crew of Christiansen tried to take care of him afterwards. But beyond that, we don't know whether he returned with the ship to the Netherlands. It seems unlikely to me, because if so, it would have made sense that they would have made mention of this in the document itself. So presumably he stayed behind again. And as far as I know, he's never mentioned again. So we don't know what happened to him afterwards.
I want to give a long and short of a quick synopsis of who he was and where he came from. So he was, as we said, he was from the island that at the time was being called La Española, correct?
Yes.
Which means the Spanish one. In fact, I believe it was the earliest of those islands to be colonized by the Spanish.
And they must have been there for at least 100 years, right?
Yeah. So they were there 100 years at this point or more. And it was called the Spanish one. That's what they called what is the Dominican Republic today. At some point, there was a reorganization of the island by the Spanish colonists who had said, everybody's coming. We're basically going to corral everybody to this southeastern section of the island. You wrote about that in your paper, and which is actually just below, approximately below where Punta Cana is today. Most people probably know that if they go to the Dominican for a vacation. But that caused a lot of unrest in and of itself, because people didn't want to be told where they had to be. They didn't want to be under an autocratic rule of some international imperialistic power. And the thinking is, at least this is what it looks like from all the evidence, this Juan Rodriguez left this island, La Española, or the Dominican Republic, he left it because of the oppression being imposed on him by the Spanish colonists. But you do point out he had been actively involved in smuggling off of that island with the Dutch specifically.
Right, in the couple
of years leading up to 1613.
Yeah, so in that sense, it seems very likely that at some point he decided that he would be better off traveling with the Dutch instead of staying on La Española.
Right, he sort of had the training. He was ready to go. And after all, Adrian Block and Hendrik Christiansen were about trade. That's what they were sent over to this new world to cultivate. The fact is, he didn't come on their ship originally. It seems that he somehow got on board this ship that was captained by a Dutchman by the name of Thijs Volkerts Mosel, and his supercargo. A supercargo is the guy who's in charge of all the goods on the ship. I know you know that, Tom, but I'm telling people who may not. A supercargo is in charge of what's on the ship, what it picks up and takes back, the trade. And that was a guy named Hans-Joris Hontum, who was, it's well documented that he was not a nice guy. And he did a bunch of real nasty things. So it's not hard to imagine why Juan Rodriguez would jump on the ship to get off the oppression being imposed on him in this uprising on this island that he essentially comes from.
Right.
Gets on a ship, because that seems like a better situation than what he's got there. Plus, he has these opportunities to trade. But by the time he sails up here from the Caribbean, he says, get me out of here. This guy's horrible. And he would rather stay on Manhattan Island by himself with only the natives, the native Algonquins here with him, than get back on that ship and go back to the Netherlands with Thijs Volkerts Mosel and this horrible Hans-Joris Hontum, right?
Chance, even a pause. We'll be right back after the break.
G'day, we're Atlassian, the makers behind popular teamwork software like Jira, Trello, and Confluence. Whether it's real-time collaboration or staying aligned on key goals, Atlassian's agile work management solutions empower dev, business, and IT teams across the whole enterprise to work more efficiently together. It's exactly why 83% of the Fortune 500 trust Atlassian every day to stay agile and move work forward. See what Atlassian can do for your teams at atlassian.com.
You take pride in your work, and so do we. We're Northern Tool, and we have every tool you can imagine, and some you've only dreamt about. Plus, our service and product knowledge is legendary. Find your pride and joy at Northern Tool. Visit our store or buy online and pick it up curbside. Northern Tool and Equipment. Quality tools for serious work.
Our anniversary sale is on at Northern Tool and Equipment. Save hundreds on pressure washers, sprayers, trailers, lawn and garden equipment, power tools, and more. Shop in-store or northerntool.com.
Tableau wasn't just any pop music star. He was the biggest thing in Korean hip-hop. But then, rumors on an anonymous internet forum started to spread, saying that Tableau wasn't who we said he was. I'm Dexter Thomas, the host of a new podcast from Vice about a bizarre conspiracy theory that became an obsession not only in Korea, but internationally. All of season one is out now for listening. You can check the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts for Authentic, the story of Tableau.
Right. Yeah, it seems very clear that he regretted his decision to get on board at that point. Yes, that's
right. And he was very happy to say, "No, I'll stay here. These Algonquins—they're very nice. And I'll set up here. Just give me some." So, and it was interesting. They didn't pay him in Dutch currency or gold or silver, guilders or anything else, because, as you said, what was he going to do with it? He's in the wilderness now, but amongst the indigenous peoples who were the Algonquin natives. The only currency that's worth anything is something that they're willing to trade something else for. And so Thijs Volkerts-Mosel, the captain, pays him rightfully his wages, but in the form of 80 hatchets.
Yeah.
And so now he's got the goods to set up essentially a small trading post here.
Indeed. Yeah. And apparently that's what he was still doing by the time ships arrived anew in the new season in 1614, because he then apparently decided that he might as well trade with Hendrik Christiansen and the crew of the Fortin, and basically act, I'm assuming, as a middleman between the local Algonquins and the Dutch ship, the Dutch trading ship. So, yes.
It definitely appears to be the case that, first off, this would have been Block's third trip. Block and Hendrik Christiansen were sort of partners. Hendrik Christiansen was a slightly younger, he was younger than Adrian Block, and he was sort of his right-hand man. But Adrian Block was a very well-regarded, well-respected, decent man from Amsterdam, very experienced sea captain who was focused on trade. Primarily supply side trade. And that's why they came here. That's why they were sent here, to go cultivate this incredible fur trade that just seemed to be there for the taking after Henry Hudson's voyage. But Block and Christiansen were diplomatic people. They were not out there knocking people around and being disrespectful or harmful to people. Whereas this other group, they were basically trying to poach on what Block and Christiansen had already established, right?
Right, yes, definitely so, because the same document describes that at some point, Mosel and Honteman and their crew, they encountered Christiansen trading with some of the locals, and they apparently became so enraged that they immediately attacked them. So the description is that they used sabers and muskets, etc., to attack the locals. They even, as the document describes it, nearly struck down one of the other Dutch crew members, and they wrecked one or several canoes in their assault. So, and that was even before they attacked Jan Rodriguez. So, right off the bat, they immediately started to behave extremely aggressively.
So the unrest that sort of developed here, while it was essentially caused by the arrival of this ship, the ship was called the Jonge Tobias, captained by Thijs Volkerts-Mosel, and this character Hans-Joris Hontem is his first man, his supercargo. The unrest started there, but it really was activated by Juan Rodriguez saying, "I'm not going to deal with you guys. I'm staying here." They pay him the hatchets. They go back to the Netherlands. Yet what really angered them was that when they got back, he was working for the competition. He was working for Adrian Block.
Yeah, that seems very clear, yes.
And that's when things really got restless, and there was some real upheaval, and it was all Dutchmen fighting Dutchmen at this point. The natives, the native Algonquins were fine because they were involved in a very vibrant trade that hadn't existed, you know, just a couple of years earlier, just 2 years earlier, it had not existed. And what I think people need to understand about the Native American trade was metal, primarily metals and cloth, was what the natives of this North America didn't really have the ability or access to produce. So primarily that metal goods and cloth goods were really valuable to these Native Americans, and they made their lives better and easier.
Yeah, but it's you can see that they the crew of Mussel, they attacked the Algonquins as well. So there's a description that several of the Algonquin, or the locals, the indigenous peoples, they fled to Christiansen's ship from their own boats because of the attack. They were clearly very shocked and very frightened, and they must have been by this sudden and from their point of view doubtlessly an unwarranted and unexpected attack.
Now keep in mind, Block and Christiansen were returning. This is their third return, to their third trip to this area, to the New York area. On their second one, they took back two Algonquin natives. That's how good their diplomacy was going with the local people of this area, that a sachem, an Indian chief, handed Block his two teenage sons and said, take them, teach them Dutch, let them teach them the trade that you're cultivating so that they can help better and that we can all do better in this trade. So he was really intertwined, Block, Adrian Block particularly, but him and Christiansen were really intertwined with the Algonquins by this point. After just a couple of years, they were really close to them. So it's clear that the natives would have felt comfortable with Block and Christiansen, and perhaps very uncomfortable with somebody like Hans-Joris Hontum or Mussel. And Hontum does have a history down the road, you know, 5 or 10 years down the road, he does some horrible things to the natives. He sticks around for a while. Then there's no doubt that he was a bad guy.
Right. No, very much so. And that's also very clear in this document, that he even states that his attack is on Juan Rodriguez is quite simply because he feels that he stole his trade. So their point of view is, these are our pelts, and we have a right to them, even though, you know, it's a free trade going on at this point. But he feels that these are his, and the fact that Jan Rodriguez is there and helping out the other Dutch crew is interfering with his right to do business there.
Isn't it crazy? Because they come and poach. They impose on the trade that Block and Christiansen had already well established, yet they're claiming that the furs that Juan Rodriguez is trading with Block and Christiansen belong to them. It's preposterous.
Absolutely, yes.
Now, for people that don't know the name Adrian Block, if you've ever been to Block Island off of the coast of Rhode Island and Montauk, that's the Adrian Block we're talking about. So that island was a key operational base in this trade that Adrian Block and Hendrik Christiansen established, going back to a 1611, actually, is when they started coming over here for the first time. So he's a really, really pivotal and important character in the true history, very much lost history, I think, to some extent, of the New York area and the island of Manhattan, is Adrian Block. And he was really a very upstanding guy, and all documentation points to that and supports that. Tom, why, if the Spanish were so busy down in the Caribbean and Florida, and the first city colonized in the continental U.S. is St. Augustine, 1565, I think it was, and Santa Fe as early as 1598, but then they actually formed the city 1607, but they were here before anybody, right? Yeah. Before any other world powers, right?
Right, yes.
Why didn't they come up here? this area.
Their original base would have been in the Caribbean. It's as you said, La Española. It was Cuba where I think Cortez sailed from when he went to Mexico and in the end conquered the Aztec Empire. They were expanding like an oil stain, if you will, from their original bases in the Caribbean across other parts of the New World. And also, most likely, it's a question of sea currents. So if you're traveling from the north of Europe, it's, I believe, easier to get to your parts, so the southern Canada, northern U.S. Parts of the New World than it is when you're sailing from Spain and you're going past the Canary Islands, where they were usually traveling through, all the way to the Caribbean. It's very hard to cross the, how do you say, to cross the Atlantic Ocean diagonally. So right. Usually you have a very specific route that you have to follow if you want to have a successful journey, basically.
Yeah, I think you're right. I also think they gravitated towards the nice weather. They didn't like the cold weather.
That might have been, yes.
Yeah. It's a fascinating story. And I think part of the fascination is that most people think of, well, yeah, the early colonists, the early settlers, English, Dutch, somewhat French, and in some cases Spanish. Now, when we say Spanish, we mean from Spain. Now, Juan Rodriguez's actual heritage, his mother was a native of the island of La Española, of the Dominican Republic, and that his father was a Spanish sailor.
At the very least, we know that the Dutch describe him first as a malaat, which is basically a mulatto. So that's somebody of mixed race, if you could say that. In the second document, there's actually a quote from Hontem where he describes Juan Rodriguez, and I will translate it immediately, as a black rascal. So he's well, clearly referring to the color of his skin. So at the very least, he was a person of color, and not a white European, if you can say it like that.
Right. It's a matter of identifying him specifically. He differed from them because he clearly had much darker skin, and that is noted in many of the records. So he really was. I mean, he was the truest immigrant you could imagine. I mean, he was of African descent that had settled on this Caribbean island, and then the product of a native of that island and a Spanish sailor. And then immediately, because of the oppression imposed on him there, comes here, but didn't originally intend to come here. He just was jumping off the ship because it was so horrible there.
Yes. Yeah. And perhaps he didn't only find it horrible on the ship, but perhaps he also liked the environment. Of course, we don't know whether he might have had previous opportunities to jump ship, but decided that the location wasn't really suitable, and that this particular location with the largely friendly indigenous people was actually a good place to get off the ship and build a new life.
And let's keep in mind, his mother was an indigenous native from another section of this new world, but he did have that in common with these people. And maybe he related to them a lot better than these Dutchmen did, for instance. And he clearly got along with them because he was here for a long time, wasn't he? By himself. And the Native Americans, correct? Over the winter.
Yes. It must have been here for at least, 10 to 12 months before the Dutch ships returned. Yes.
Right. So. Before Adrian Block showed up and said, hey, what are you doing here? And by that time, he spoke the language, or most likely did, because he had to be communicating with these people.
Right.
So then he's a really valuable asset to these guys, isn't he?
Indeed, yeah, he must have been. It must have been a great opportunity for them to come back to the New World and encounter a man who did not only speak the local language, but also was probably able to speak enough Dutch to communicate with them. And if not, then they may have had crew members who were able to speak enough Spanish to communicate with him. In any case, there must have been they must have been delighted to find somebody who they could easily use as an intermediary between the locals and themselves.
And for a group of guys primarily driven by and focused on trade, he's already the local trade because he had the 80 hatchets and he was. You know, he clearly set up shop over the winter and look, I'll provide you with hatchets. You keep me warm and keep me fed. And, you know, we'll be symbiotic and we'll live harmoniously. It's clearly what they did. It's just an amazing story. So Block comes back. Rodriguez gets on board with him, but we don't know where he goes from there, do we?
No. So, well, as I said, we know that he, the crew, well, specifically also Hontem, but well, in general, people from Mossel's crew, they attacked him when they realized that he was helping the trade of Christiansen and Block, right. And they beat him up. They definitely wounded him. It's described as much. He did not. Well, he did defend himself, so he was able to wrest a sword from one of the attacking crew members.
Right.
They specifically make mention of the fact that later one of the other crew of Christiansen returned the sword to the original owner, which is always an interesting detail to mention, but in any case... but unfortunately, after that, they don't mention Rodriguez himself anymore, so we don't know... what happened to him afterwards. We know that he was wounded. We can presume that he was, well, taken care of in somehow by, in some way by Christiansen's crew. Mm-hmm. And what I'm presuming is that at the very least, he did not return with them to the Netherlands. So, because as I said, it would have made sense for the people giving the disposition in the notarial act to then mention that this man was now also in Amsterdam with them, or perhaps he might have even been involved directly with giving the statement. So most likely he stayed behind again, and we just never hear from him again. So that's a shame. It might have been that by that point he decided that it was too dangerous to stay there on the coast and help the Dutch with their trade because, he tried it and he got wounded.
These Dutch are serious. There's some serious unrest around here.
Right. So it might have been that he decided to travel elsewhere and try his luck. But yeah, anything is possible, really.
Now hold that thought, because we'll be right back.
Yeah, it's the Priceline Negotiator, and I'm here because I'm tired. You getting less. Less sunshine, less fun, less bang for your buck. It's time for more. That's why I'm getting you up to 60% off your favorite hotels, along with exclusive deals on rental cars and flights. Because when you save more, you can do more. More sunshine, more fun, a lot more for your dollar. Every trip is a big deal. So visit Priceline.com to get more out of your next trip.
Tableau wasn't just any pop music star. He was the biggest thing in Korean hip-hop. But then, rumors on an anonymous internet forum started to spread, saying that Tableau wasn't who he said he was. I'm Dexter Thomas, the host of a new podcast from Vice about a bizarre conspiracy theory that became an obsession not only in Korea, but internationally. All of season one is out now for listening. You can check the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts for Authentic, the story of Tableau.
Race, class, and power have always been at the center of the biggest conflicts in American cities and schools. This summer, School Colors, the new series from Code Switch at NPR, takes you to the front lines of that struggle. We'll explore why a school district in the most diverse place in the world needed a diversity plan, and why the process went off the rails. Listen to the Code Switch podcast from NPR on the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There is another interesting detail that you unearthed in this article, in this work, is that there was a lot of local uprisings starting on the island of La Española, on the island that is the Dominican today. And there was a group of musketmen, basically, who frequently would stand up to the local Spanish powers that be and revolt about one thing or another. And the point being that this Juan Rodriguez who came here, he definitely knew how to handle a musket, which was not an innate thing in 1613. Not everybody even knew what a musket was.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Although muskets were for that time relatively easy to operate, but it's not something you just know. You have to learn it.
Right. So I mean, he's half native from a Caribbean island. There's no saying though everybody there is going to have experience with a musket.
No, but in any case, I think it's very clear that he knew how to take care of himself. So
that's my point. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't jump ship and then survive for a year in an environment that's unknown to you if you don't know how to manage yourself and to handle yourself in unknown situations. And as said, he was beat up by the crew of Mossel, but it took several men to do it. So it's not like he wasn't able to defend himself either. It's just he was very clearly overpowered, as anybody would be if you're up against several men all at once. But yeah, he was definitely a man who knew how to survive and how to handle himself. So I can very well imagine that he thrived afterwards, and he was just never encountered by anybody who thought it worth to describe him again.
Exactly. He seems like a very handy guy. I mean, you could really handle himself. Smart guy. He very well may have become somewhat of a pioneer and just lived amongst the native people for the rest of his life, being that he became a trade specialist.
Indeed, yeah, it seems likely to me. So obviously, well, as he was wounded, that's not necessarily something you recover from in those days,
right?
But we can assume that he did not die of it, at the very least. At least not while the Dutch were there, because otherwise it seems likely to me that they would have mentioned it, because that would have, very much made the case against Hontom and Mossel much more severe if they managed to murder somebody. So he most likely survived the ordeal. And based on what we know of him, it then seems very likely to me that he made his way elsewhere to continue his search for a better life, basically.
Amazing stuff, Tom. It's just, I don't know why he's so intriguing, but I don't think I'm the only one either. I think most people who know something about the early history of New York and New Netherland are very intrigued with this guy. He's such an interesting, nebulous character, and so much drama around him. It's just so fun hearing about it. And you have a great knowledge base about him, and obviously from the primary sources. I really, really thank you for coming on with us. Tell me again, you wanted to mention the CUNY Dominican Studies Department?
Yeah, so the Dominican Studies Institute of the City University of New York, they were the ones who commissioned me to do the original research. The book is also their publication. So I wanted to make sure that they are mentioned. It was mostly Anthony Stevens Acevedo, as I mentioned, who so he was a professor there. I think he's retired now, actually, but he was the main author of the manuscript. I assisted mostly by transcribing the documents and giving my view on what might have happened. But yeah, it's mostly them who were, I think, the people in the past decades who were the most interested, or the first interested in Juan Rodriguez and what happened to him and his place in the early history of New York, because obviously he's one of the first real immigrants to live in your great city.
Truly, truly. Well, I commend the three of you. You put together a remarkable paper, and if people are interested in digging into it a little more than we've gotten into it, it is available online via CUNY. Well, actually, it's on academicworks.cuny.edu, and you can find it. It's called Juan Rodriguez and the Beginnings of New York City. And this is Mr. Tom Vetterings. Ladies and gentlemen, we thank you so much for coming on, Tom. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for inviting me. It's an interesting endeavor, so I look forward to hearing more when everything's available.
Great, man. Very good. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and have a good day.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Yes, bye.
Folks, we want to thank you once again for listening. Remind you to please listen in order and tell you that we realize that there's a lot to digest on this untamed wild island of Manhattan. And for that very reason, we've set up an email just for you. So whenever you have a question, just email us at thepodcastisland@gmail.com. Thepodcastisland, no caps, no punctuation, no spaces, @gmail.com. And you can also find that email address on our website, thepodcastisland.com. Send us as many questions as you have. Email us as often as you like, because your questions and comments, if they're nice, will be the content of our periodic review episodes, which will come approximately every 4 or 5 episodes. Because as we've said, this story is complicated, but that's okay, because the doctor is in and you will be kept up to date. So climb aboard. History is cool. Island is an original production, researched, written, and produced by Chance Kelly and Dr. Yap Jacobs. Research Associate James Mallon for Cavalry Audio and iHeartRadio. And I am your host, Chance Kelly, thanking you for boarding our voyage of discovery en route to saying, wow, history is cool. We'll see you next time.
Tableau wasn't just any pop music star. He was the biggest thing in Korean hip-hop. But then, rumors on an anonymous internet forum started to spread, saying that Tableau wasn't who we said he was. I'm Dexter Thomas, the host of a new podcast from Vice about a bizarre conspiracy theory that became an obsession not only in Korea, but internationally. All of season 1 is out now for listening. You can check the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts for Authentic, the story of Tableau.
Race, class, and power have always been at the center of the biggest conflicts in American cities and schools. This summer, School Colors, the new series from Code Switch at NPR, takes you to the front lines of that struggle. We'll explore why a school district in the most diverse place in the world needed a diversity plan, and why the process went off the rails. Listen to the Code Switch podcast from NPR on the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami is a new podcast about, you guessed it, crime in Miami. As Miami natives, we like to say that South Florida is a sunny place for shady people.
I'm Kareem Tapsch.
And I'm Joey Dowd. Each week, this podcast will bring you new stories of true crimes committed right under the Florida sun.
From the outrageous
to the utterly bizarre. This is Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami, a new true crime podcast.
Listen to Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami starting May 18th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.